Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series 2017. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers. And when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you're all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What did the girl want to see on her visit to the City Art Gallery? B. What new feature of the City Art Gallery is mentioned?
We went to the City Art Gallery again with our teacher the other day. She took us to study the landscape paintings. A few were impressive, I suppose, though not really my thing.
You should have checked out the portraits. They're all in this newly opened exhibition. It's on the second floor.
I had a quick look because they're next to the sculpture section and that was what I'd been looking forward to.
I like the way the building's been redecorated, though the entrance hall isn't any different and that cafe's still pretty basic.
But did you see the information desks on every floor? They weren't there last time. We went to the City Art Gallery again with our teacher the other day. She took us to study the landscape paintings. A few were impressive, I suppose, though not really my thing.
You should have checked out the portraits. They're all in this newly opened exhibition. It's on the second floor.
I had a quick look because they're next to the sculpture section and that was what I'd been looking forward to.
I like the way the building's been redecorated, though the entrance hall isn't any different. And that cafe's still pretty basic.
But did you see the information desks on every floor? They weren't there last time.
Question 2. A. How deep did the man dive? B. What did the woman enjoy most during her dive?
I went diving in Thailand last summer. I did my advanced certificate years ago, so I'm qualified to dive to a depth of 30 metres. In fact, we didn't manage more than 16 metres. We could have gone down to 18 metres, which is as far as my friend is allowed to go legally, as he's only got a basic diving certificate.
You must have seen some amazing things. I've heard that the marine life is fantastic in Thailand.
And where did you go diving?
Florida. My friends wanted to see the fish and other creatures, but we discovered some caves. They were much better than exploring shipwrecks.
I went diving in Thailand last summer. I did my advanced certificate years ago, so I'm qualified to dive to a depth of 30 metres. In fact, we didn't manage more than 16 metres. We could have gone down to 18 metres, which is as far as my friend is allowed to go legally, as he's only got a basic diving certificate.
You must have seen some amazing things. I've heard that the marine life is fantastic in Thailand.
And where did you go diving?
Florida. My friends wanted to see the fish and other creatures, but we discovered some caves. They were much better than exploring shipwrecks.
Question 3. A. What does the speaker usually design? B. What has inspired her latest work?
I'm a fashion designer and I think people are getting tired of wearing the same old T-shirts and jeans. And though I've occasionally produced those products, in my country people want something different. I want to satisfy that need. I'm well known for the long dresses I've designed. That's been the majority of my work over the years. But right now I'm experimenting with things based on 1920s fashions. I find these really give me great ideas. I'm not so interested in later periods like the 1960s. But I'm sticking with the bright colours people expect me to use. And as before, I'm working with cheap but comfortable fabrics. I'm a fashion designer and I think people are getting tired of wearing the same old T-shirts and jeans. And though I've occasionally produced those products, in my country people want something different. I want to satisfy that need. I'm well known for the long dresses I've designed. That's been the majority of my work over the years. But right now I'm experimenting with things based on 1920s fashions. I find these really give me great ideas. I'm not so interested in later periods like the 1960s. But I'm sticking with the bright colours people expect me to use. And as before, I'm working with cheap but comfortable fabrics.
Question 4. A. What are the competitors given before the race? B. What do many competitors usually remove from their bags before the race?
The Marathon of the Sands is a long-distance race which is run in the Sahara Desert in Morocco. The organisers are responsible for providing tents for competitors to sleep in, but competitors have to bring their own sleeping bag. Everything else must be carried in a rucksack, weighing no more than 15 kilos. Organisers hand out water during the race, so the competitors don't need to worry about that. But many arrive with heavy bags and so have to throw away some items. Food is rarely given up, but it's common to get rid of clothing. Apparently, runners are reluctant to leave behind their MP3 players because music keeps them going during the race. The Marathon of the Sands is a long-distance race which is run in the Sahara Desert in Morocco. The organisers are responsible for providing tents for competitors to sleep in, but competitors have to bring their own sleeping bag. Everything else must be carried in a rucksack, weighing no more than 15 kilos. Organisers hand out water during the race, so the competitors don't need to worry about that. But many arrive with heavy bags and so have to throw away some items. Food is rarely given up, but it's common to get rid of clothing. Apparently, runners are reluctant to leave behind their MP3 players because music keeps them going during the race.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a talk given by a man about the early history of the cinema in the United States. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
I'm going to tell you about the development of the cinema in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The first films were something of a novelty to audiences who had simply never experienced anything like them before. Films in the 1890s had no sound and were barely a minute in length. This was quite a contrast with contemporary shows or theatre productions people saw that lasted at least an hour. Initially, people were not able to watch complex stories. Instead, films simply presented everyday scenes, which no doubt people at that time found interesting. Alternatively, audiences might be fortunate enough to see sporting events, and these were regarded as the most thrilling things to watch. Films about adventures or journeys came later in the 20th century. Initially, a surprisingly large number of films featured crime. It seems that their popularity was mainly the result of a famous film released in 1901, which showed someone who had stolen food from a shop being chased by a policeman. From 1910 onwards, although audiences were still mostly interested in watching entertainment, such as comedy and drama, it became possible for people visiting the cinema to catch up with the news as well. These short films gave audiences some idea of what was happening in the world, and so had an educational purpose. Films were sometimes shown at big theatres. They would be a small part of a programme featuring other entertainment, and so weren't the main attraction there. What many people aren't aware of is that films were shown in empty shops, but the audience numbers were limited. To satisfy the growing demand, businessmen began constructing buildings that were completely dedicated to the screening of films and nothing else. Their idea was to model cinema buildings on European opera houses, and they were clearly designed to impress people. Cinemas were known as picture palaces, which reveals just how luxurious they could be. Owners of cinemas wanted audiences to relax and feel as comfortable as possible. Between 1910 and 1920, many cinemas installed seats that were much better than before, and there were soft carpets too. People were even more amazed by the fact that there was air conditioning. This was something quite new for them. Compared to today, films in this period were made with fairly simple technology, and all films were accompanied by music that was produced by an orchestra. Some cinemas even employed someone who stood to the side of the screen and explained what was happening as all the action took place. Films were shot with cameras that were fixed in their position, although some techniques, such as close-ups, were introduced surprisingly early, back in 1900. A few special effects were possible, although these were very basic by modern standards. Are there any questions before I move on to consider the period after 1920?
Now you will hear the talk again.
I'm going to tell you about the development of the cinema in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The first films were something of a novelty to audiences who had simply never experienced anything like them before. Films in the 1890s had no sound and were barely a minute in length. This was quite a contrast with contemporary shows or theatre productions people saw that lasted at least an hour. Initially, people were not able to watch complex stories. Instead, films simply presented everyday scenes, which no doubt people at that time found interesting. Alternatively, audiences might be fortunate enough to see sporting events, and these were regarded as the most thrilling things to watch. Films about adventures or journeys came later in the 20th century. Initially, a surprisingly large number of films featured crime. It seems that their popularity was mainly the result of a famous film released in 1901, which showed someone who had stolen food from a shop being chased by a policeman. From 1910 onwards, although audiences were still mostly interested in watching entertainment, such as comedy and drama, it became possible for people visiting the cinema to catch up with the news as well. These short films gave audiences some idea of what was happening in the world, and so had an educational purpose. Films were sometimes shown at big theatres. They would be a small part of a programme featuring other entertainment, and so weren't the main attraction there. What many people aren't aware of is that films were shown in empty shops, but the audience numbers were limited. To satisfy the growing demand, businessmen began constructing buildings that were completely dedicated to the screening of films and nothing else. Their idea was to model cinema buildings on European opera houses, and they were clearly designed to impress people. cinemas were known as picture palaces, which reveals just how luxurious they could be. Owners of cinemas wanted audiences to relax and feel as comfortable as possible. Between 1910 and 1920, many cinemas installed seats that were much better than before, and there were soft carpets too. People were even more amazed by the fact that there was air conditioning. This was something quite new for them. Compared to today, films in this period were made with fairly simple technology, and all films were accompanied by music that was produced by an orchestra. Some cinemas even employed someone who stood to the side of the screen and explained what was happening as all the action took place. Films were shot with cameras that were fixed in their position, although some techniques, such as close-ups, were introduced surprisingly early, back in 1900. A few special effects were possible, although these were very basic by modern standards. Are there any questions before I move on to consider the period after 1920?
That is the end of the talk. In a moment you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about working in teams. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I was in a school hockey team that was playing pretty badly when I joined. I don't think the team was really pulling together, and there were too many strong personalities who often had arguments. Despite this, we managed to turn things round and actually won our last 5 games, which wasn't expected. It was a great success, which still gives me a lot of pleasure when I think about it. Our captain did a good job. And maybe one day I'd like to have a go at that role.
Speaker 2.
I was a member of a team that took part in a quiz competition. We were a strange mix of people who wouldn't normally spend time together, but that didn't matter because the important thing was that we could answer all these tricky questions. We did quite well, but we didn't win. I tried my best, but couldn't believe how few answers I could come up with, and near the end was just sitting there looking puzzled. I really felt that I was letting the team down by not saying very much.
Speaker 3.
We had to do a school project last term, which involved working in a team. The teacher said the final result was pretty good, though I felt there was room for improvement. I was the one asked to lead the team, and though I'd been a bit reluctant to take that on, I found myself really getting into it and having fun. One or two people didn't contribute much, but that always happens, and at least we didn't spend hours arguing about how to do things.
Speaker 4.
We do some classwork exercises in teams these days, and it can make the atmosphere quite tense and competitive. I know this can be motivating for students, and I enjoy it sometimes. This time, what we were being asked to do was a problem-solving task that needed peace and quiet, and so I was reluctant to work with any classmates, but since they were my friends, it wasn't too bad. I think I ended up doing most of the hard work, to be honest.
Speaker 5.
I was in a volleyball team last year. It didn't matter to me that I played a fairly small role most weeks because I really enjoyed myself. We usually played opponents who were more skillful, and so we didn't take losing too seriously. It wasn't about the results, it was about being together. I was amazed by how much some of the girls put into the matches. When I saw a friend keep playing even though she had a bit of an injury, it pushed me to try harder too.
Speaker 6.
At work we had to do a survey. You know, go out on the street and ask people questions. We were supposed to do it in a team, and we all got on perfectly well and had a good laugh when we sat down and planned everything. I think we enjoyed ourselves a bit too much when actually we needed to get things done more quickly and efficiently. I was irritated by how the day just slipped away with nothing much to show for it by 5 o'clock.
Now you will hear the 6 speakers again. Speaker 1.
I was in a school hockey team that was playing pretty badly when I joined. I don't think the team was really pulling together, and there were too many strong personalities who often had arguments. Despite this, we managed to turn things round and actually won our last 5 games, which wasn't expected. It was a great success, which still gives me a lot of pleasure when I think about it. Our captain did a good job, and maybe one day I'd like to have a go at that role.
Speaker 2.
I was a member of a team that took part in a quiz competition. We were a strange mix of people who wouldn't normally spend time together, but that didn't matter because the important thing was that we could answer all these tricky questions. We did quite well, but we didn't win. I tried my best, but couldn't believe how few answers I could come up with, and near the end was just sitting there looking puzzled. I really felt that I was letting the team down by not saying very much.
Speaker 3. We had to do a school project last term, which involved working in a team. The teacher said the final result was pretty good, though I felt there was room for improvement. I was the one asked to lead the team, and though I'd been a bit reluctant to take that on, I found myself really getting into it and having fun. One or two people didn't contribute much, but that always happens, and at least we didn't spend hours arguing about how to do things. Speaker 4.
We do some classwork exercises in teams these days, and it can make the atmosphere quite tense and competitive. I know this can be motivating for students, and I enjoy it sometimes. This time, what we were being asked to do was a problem-solving task that needed peace and quiet, and so I was reluctant to work with any classmates, but since they were my friends, it wasn't too bad. I think I ended up doing most of the hard work, to be honest.
Speaker 5.
I was in a volleyball team last year. It didn't matter to me that I played a fairly small role most weeks because I really enjoyed myself. We usually played opponents who were more skillful, and so we didn't take losing too seriously. It wasn't about the results, it was about being together. I was amazed by how much some of the girls put into the matches. When I saw a friend keep playing even though she had a bit of an injury, it pushed me to try harder too.
Speaker 6.
At work we had to do a survey. You know, go out on the street and ask people questions. We were supposed to do it in a team, and we all got on perfectly well and had a good laugh when we sat down and planned everything. I think we enjoyed ourselves a bit too much when actually we needed to get things done more quickly and efficiently. I was irritated by how the day just slipped away with nothing much to show for it by 5 o'clock.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear an interview with Shirley Sullivan about her work as a tour guide. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, Shirley. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us today. What gave you the idea of becoming a tour guide?
Like many people, when I was young, I dreamed about travelling the world, but I didn't see it as something I'd do for a living. Then, one summer, I had to show some American relatives around my town, and to my surprise, I realised I could do it well and also answer their questions. Despite having a friend who worked as a guide, it had never occurred to me I might be good at this job too.
So what's the most effective way to get ready for a tour you're going to lead?
I'm given helpful notes on all the tourist attractions by the company I work for, though these aren't always sufficiently detailed. I treat anything from the internet with a certain amount of caution, as it's not necessarily accurate. I tend to devote most of my time to a few history books, because the facts and figures there are reliable and will never be out of date.
What is the most essential characteristic a good tour guide needs to have?
Tourists can be difficult. They get tired, they complain about minor problems, or they don't want to cooperate and follow your instructions. But whatever happens, the guide has to keep their cool and not get annoyed. Having the qualifications and the relevant knowledge matters in this job, and so does being enthusiastic about what's in front of you.
Do you find it hard when things go wrong?
I plan carefully, but sometimes museums or art galleries aren't open when they are supposed to be. In that situation, I'm calm because I usually have an alternative plan. If members of my group aren't punctual, that can create serious difficulties for me because the whole schedule is affected. Rain or cold is often something that guides worry about, but it doesn't usually bother me. You can have fun whether the sun's shining or not.
Of course. Though, how do you cope when someone asks a question you don't know the answer to?
Well, in my experience, it's quite common for a few tourists to have done research and so they're quite knowledgeable. Some guides might panic if they get a difficult question from someone like that, or, even worse, just pretend they know the answer and hope nobody notices. I find complete honesty is best, and tricky questions really encourage me to work harder in future and build up my knowledge.
Do you ever do guided tours of the town you come from?
Yes, I do actually, and I'm very proud of my town and its beauty. And it's surprising that we don't attract more tourists. Those who do come usually comment on how interesting it is. I'm always determined to prove just how fascinating it is, and I don't mind if people think I'm too enthusiastic. There's so much to see and never enough time, so visitors inevitably get an incomplete picture, which is a real shame.
And I'm curious about one other thing. Do you take guided tours when you go on holiday?
Well, I might occasionally go on a museum tour. I can learn some new techniques from a guide because everyone does things differently. Generally, I prefer to sit in a new place and soak up the atmosphere and not fill my head with new information. I just want to switch off. Although I know guides who choose to have a break from their jobs by exploring a new place alone, I quite like travelling in a group even when I'm not working.
Are there any particular tours you would like to do in the future?
I've been involved in a range of tours so far and enjoyed everything, especially when I worked with young students. One area I haven't explored is combining city tours with activities based in the wild, like mountaineering. I've been offered tours for groups of perhaps only 5 or 6 people, quite exclusive, but I think bigger groups tend to be more rewarding.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Shirley.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, Shirley. Thanks for agreeing to talk to us today. What gave you the idea of becoming a tour guide?
Like many people, when I was young, I dreamed about travelling the world, but I didn't see it as something I'd do for a living. Then, one summer, I had to show some American relatives around my town, and to my surprise, I realised I could do it well and also answer their questions. Despite having a friend who worked as a guide, it had never occurred to me I might be good at this job too.
So what's the most effective way to get ready for a tour you're going to lead?
I'm given helpful notes on all the tourist attractions by the company I work for, though these aren't always sufficiently detailed. I treat anything from the internet with a certain amount of caution, as it's not necessarily accurate. I tend to devote most of my time to a few history books, because the facts and figures there are reliable and will never be out of date.
What is the most essential characteristic a good tour guide needs to have?
Tourists can be difficult. They get tired, they complain about minor problems, or they don't want to cooperate and follow your instructions. But whatever happens, the guide has to keep their cool and not get annoyed. Having the qualifications and the relevant knowledge matters in this job, and so does being enthusiastic about what's in front of you.
Do you find it hard when things go wrong?
I plan carefully, but sometimes museums or art galleries aren't open when they are supposed to be. In that situation, I'm calm because I usually have an alternative plan. If members of my group aren't punctual, that can create serious difficulties for me because the whole schedule is affected. Rain or cold is often something that guides worry about, but it doesn't usually bother me. You can have fun whether the sun's shining or not.
Of course. Though, how do you cope when someone asks a question you don't know the answer to?
Well, in my experience, it's quite common for a few tourists to have done research and so they're quite knowledgeable. Some guides might panic if they get a difficult question from someone like that, or, even worse, just pretend they know the answer and hope nobody notices. I find complete honesty is best, and tricky questions really encourage me to work harder in future and build up my knowledge.
Do you ever do guided tours of the town you come from?
Yes, I do actually, and I'm very proud of my town and its beauty. And it's surprising that we don't attract more tourists. Those who do come usually comment on how interesting it is. I'm always determined to prove just how fascinating it is, and I don't mind if people think I'm too enthusiastic. There's so much to see and never enough time, so visitors inevitably get an incomplete picture, which is a real shame.
And I'm curious about one other thing. Do you take guided tours when you go on holiday?
Well, I might occasionally go on a museum tour. I can learn some new techniques from a guide because everyone does things differently. Generally, I prefer to sit in a new place and soak up the atmosphere and not fill my head with new information. I just want to switch off. Although I know guides who choose to have a break from their jobs by exploring a new place alone, I quite like travelling in a group, even when I'm not working.
Are there any particular tours you would like to do in the future?
I've been involved in a range of tours so far and enjoyed everything, especially when I worked with young students. One area I haven't explored is combining city tours with activities based in the wild, like mountaineering. I've been offered tours for groups of perhaps only 5 or 6 people, quite exclusive, but I think bigger groups tend to be more rewarding.
Sounds good. Thank you very much, Shirley.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Part A. You will hear a man called Ben Hendricks giving a talk about ice yachting. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Thank you for inviting me today to talk to you about ice yachting, sometimes also called ice sailing. For those who aren't familiar with this extreme sport, it is done in narrow boats known as ice yachts, which can reach a speed of 180 kilometers per hour. The boats are fitted with three blades underneath so that they can slide on ice. The front blade is used for steering the boat, while the sail, when carefully positioned, increases the speed but also makes the boat come to a halt. Ice yachts don't come equipped with a brake, so slowing down is sometimes tricky and requires lots of practice. I have been ice yachting for over 20 years, and now also volunteer as an instructor in the local ice yachting club. It can take years to fully master the art of ice yachting, and among the biggest obstacles for people who are starting this hobby are strong winds and the harsh environment. These days, the amount of time that professional ice yachters can practice their sport is limited by the mild winters we've been having lately. This is a big drawback for the majority. Many yachters are turning to smaller ice yachts, which are significantly lighter in weight and can be easily transported. The deciding factor for me when I was choosing my own ice yacht was the flexibility it provides in terms of where I can go ice yachting. The low cost also appeals to many. Despite the thrill people get from ice yachting, this sport still isn't as popular as other extreme sports. Having said that, there's a reasonable number of competitions for ice yachters to attend. The annual Lake Baikal race in Russia is well known for the speed some of the boats reach, although what never ceases to amaze me are all the boat designs which people have created. It gives me ideas for my own ice yacht. The more often people go to competitions like these, the greater their range of friends becomes, so every time it seems like a big reunion. I know that some of you have already expressed an interest in taking up ice yachting, so I want to talk about safety now, which should come first, no matter what. It goes without saying that wearing helmets is compulsory. I always tell my students they should never underestimate the importance of proper gloves, which protect you from the extreme cold. In addition to that, our club encourages a so-called buddy system, which means never going ice yachting on your own.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Thank you for inviting me today to talk to you about ice yachting, sometimes also called ice sailing. For those who aren't familiar with this extreme sport, it is done in narrow boats known as ice yachts, which can reach a speed of 180 kilometers per hour. The boats are fitted with three blades underneath so that they can slide on ice. The front blade is used for steering the boat, while the sail, when carefully positioned, increases the speed but also makes the boat come to a halt. Ice yachts don't come equipped with a brake, so slowing down is sometimes tricky and requires lots of practice. I have been ice yachting for over 20 years and now also volunteer as an instructor in the local ice yachting club. It can take years to fully master the art of ice yachting, and among the biggest obstacles for people who are starting this hobby are strong winds and the harsh environment. These days, the amount of time that professional ice yachters can practice their sport is limited by the mild winters we've been having lately. This is a big drawback for the majority. Many yachters are turning to smaller ice yachts, which are significantly lighter in weight and can be easily transported. The deciding factor for me when I was choosing my own ice yacht was the flexibility it provides in terms of where I can go ice yachting. The low cost also appeals to many. Despite the thrill people get from ice yachting, this sport still isn't as popular as other extreme sports. Having said that, there's a reasonable number of competitions for ice yachters to attend. The annual Lake Baikal race in Russia is well known for the speed some of the boats reach, although what never ceases to amaze me are all the boat designs which people have created. It gives me ideas for my own ice yacht. The more often people go to competitions like these, the greater their range of friends becomes, so every time it seems like a big reunion. I know that some of you have already expressed an interest in taking up ice yachting, so I want to talk about safety now, which should come first, no matter what. It goes without saying that wearing helmets is compulsory. I always tell my students they should never underestimate the importance of proper gloves, which protect you from the extreme cold. In addition to that, our club encourages a so-called buddy system, which means never going ice yachting on your own.
Question 8. Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about ice yachting and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Hi, Paola.
Hi, Fred. Everything okay?
Well, you know the ice yachting talk yesterday?
Yeah.
I wanted to find out more about it, so I've had a look online.
Well, actually, my father has an ice yacht, and I've tried sailing it myself a couple of times. So if you want, I can help you.
That'd be great. Well, so far, I've found some information about the history of the sport. According to one website, it dates back to the 17th century, when the first boats with skates appeared on frozen rivers and canals. They were mainly used by fishermen to transport goods during the winter months, but it soon became a fun activity which all kinds of people across northern Europe in countries like Sweden and Finland enjoyed. By the end of the 18th century, settlers emigrating from the Netherlands took it to the US, where it became an immediate success, and many ice yachting clubs were quickly set up, like the Hudson River Club in New York.
That's right. My father actually knows some of the current members and has a few old photos of the original boats. In comparison, the new ice yachts look really impressive and sleek, and the way they move makes me think of graceful animals. Some of the first models resemble square boxes more than anything else. I guess nowadays it's much easier to build modern models using the latest materials, which weren't available back then.
That's interesting. I know that those old ice yachts on the Hudson River could go pretty fast. Horses wouldn't have been able to outrun them, and even cars would have struggled to keep up. What the ice yachters often did for fun was race against the trains that ran alongside the river. Going at such high speed must have felt great, but potentially extremely dangerous.
That's why it's so important to know what you're doing. It's basically low friction between the blades and the ice that means the boats can go at up to 5 times the speed of the wind. As far as I know, boat size makes very little difference. Anyway, if you like speed, you'll love it.
Do you think your father would let me have a go in his ice yacht?
His boat would be far too difficult for you to handle because you're a complete beginner. He's got a state-of-the-art type of ice yacht known as Endeavour, which is used in races. You'd need to start off on a different one called Optimist. That's much more stable and helps learners gain confidence.
OK, I'll look into that. Thanks, Paola.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Hi, Paola.
Hi, Fred. Everything okay?
Well, you know the ice yachting talk yesterday?
Yeah.
I wanted to find out more about it, so I've had a look online.
Well, actually, my father has an ice yacht, and I've tried sailing it myself a couple of times. So if you want, I can help you.
That'd be great. Well, so far, I've found some information about the history of the sport. According to one website, it dates back to the 17th century, when the first boats with skates appeared on frozen rivers and canals. They were mainly used by fishermen to transport goods during the winter months, but it soon became a fun activity which all kinds of people across northern Europe in countries like Sweden and Finland enjoyed. By the end of the 18th century, settlers emigrating from the Netherlands took it to the US, where it became an immediate success, and many ice yachting clubs were quickly set up. Like the Hudson River Club in New York.
That's right. My father actually knows some of the current members and has a few old photos of the original boats. In comparison, the new ice yachts look really impressive and sleek, and the way they move makes me think of graceful animals. Some of the first models resemble square boxes more than anything else. I guess nowadays it's much easier to build modern models using the latest materials, which weren't available back then.
That's interesting. I know that those old ice yachts on the Hudson River could go pretty fast. Horses wouldn't have been able to outrun them, and even cars would have struggled to keep up. What the ice yachters often did for fun was race against the trains that ran alongside the river. Going at such high speed must have felt great, but potentially extremely dangerous.
That's why it's so important to know what you're doing. It's basically low friction between the blades and the ice that means the boats can go at up to 5 times the speed of the wind. As far as I know, boat size makes very little difference. Anyway, if you like speed, you'll love it.
Do you think your father would let me have a go in his ice yacht?
His boat would be far too difficult for you to handle because you're a complete beginner. He's got a state-of-the-art type of ice yacht known as Endeavour, which is used in races. You'd need to start off on a different one called Optimist. That's much more stable and helps learners gain confidence.
OK, I'll look into that. Thanks, Paola.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.